Coming up next on Tech News Today, Google might have a bigger problem with fake news than even Facebook. Also, Fitbit has a new wearable for all you sleep trackers out there. A major spam empire is toppled, and we get an inside look at how it operates. Kyle Orland from Ars Technica tells us all about why Zelda Breath of the Wild is so dang awesome, and we try to accept the fact that we've all been a troll at some point in our life. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1718, recorded Monday, March 6th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase.
Well, hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you everything you need to know about technology that happened today or around today. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes on the Monday, it's today and maybe a little bit of yesterday because yesterday was Sunday, maybe even Saturday. Sometimes we even go back as far as Friday and talk about video games.
It's true.
We might do a little bit of that today.
We might do a little bit. Should we get started?
Yeah, let's talk about the not video game stuff.
Okay. Writing in Fortune, Matthew Ingram says Google's fake news problem could be worse than Facebook's. Over the weekend, several sources pointed out that Google's featured snippets stories spread news that former President Obama was planning a coup and that women are evil. This news came from those boxes you see at the top of Google's search results that provide one-word answers to questions. Before this problem was fixed, if you asked Google if President Obama was planning a coup, Google answered with a quote from an article from a conspiracy site called Secrets of the Fed, and the answer was that yes, Obama is planning a coup, and he is in league with communists from China. If you check now, Ingram says the answer comes up with several results about Google's fake news problem. I think this is both a fake news problem and a problem with our asking our assistants or our devices, questioning them, asking them questions and expecting them to have the right answer, or the fact that there's even one answer to most questions, as we know there are many answers to questions, except maybe what the weather is, though they're good at that. They're not good at answering which presidents are members of the KKK, because apparently there was also in that box several presidents that are not, in fact, or were not, in fact, members of the KKK.
Even though it said that there were.
Yes. Now, the boxes are supposed to help you to know what to trust. Like, that's what I felt like the box meant. Like, I feel like I know what a supported result means. I know what the first result means. Not necessarily true, but maybe, you know, the most popular in the box. I thought that was supposed to tell me what the truth. So I'm confused. There's been lots of studies that say just general trust in Google is too high at this point.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people rely on what Google says and you know, bank on it as kind of gold, whatever the result is. Danny Sullivan, I think, was the one that kind of kicked off a lot of this discussion over the weekend. He had a really great article where he kind of went into detail as far as like what that what the featured snippets is all about. You know, he kind of dispelled the myth, which my initial thought was, well, maybe these sites have figured out how to game it. And he actually points out it's not likely that any of the sites themselves did anything to manipulate Google. This is really a failing of Google's AI and the algorithmic decisions that Google is making to determine what can be featured as a featured snippet. He pointed out that Google processes 5 billion plus search queries every single day, that's insane. Just think about that number. Featured snippets apparently appears around 15% of the time, according to a report that he quoted. And that amounts, so then if you don't figure that the math, that amounts to somewhere around a billion per day. And I mean, that's just, that's so many when you're talking about numbers and you're talking about a computer making determinations as far as what appears in this box, there are going to be false positives. The problem is, I mean, I how many people question what they see there?
Yeah, mm-hmm. More people should question. I think Google should say, check other sources. I mean, that could be something that's built into the Google Home or, you know, Amazon's.
And not make a solid determination of,
right,
this is the official answer of what you're looking, but rather kind of, here's one of the answers that we found. Feel free to search yourself, right, or whatever the case may
be. We think maybe Obama is a part of this coup, but maybe check some other sources.
How do you tell an algorithm, though, that like something like that might be ridiculous and that this is obviously not accurate? You know,
well,
what I mean?
That's what Facebook is doing. You know, you've seen that it's like this could be fake news. It says something like that.
Absolutely. But a large part of what they're doing there is they're enlisting people and, mm-hmm, you know, services that are helping them check. And there's also the network effect of, you know, how many people are sharing this, or when they're sharing it, are they also are other people reporting it? And that's, mm-hmm, a signal.
Right.
And that's a huge difference between kind of how Facebook is tackling this problem and the requirements around what Google has to do to solve this problem, because you really don't have that network effect. Social or Google Plus isn't going to be any help in this regard.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, they've responded, you know, we know. Basically, they said, unfortunately, there are times when Google features a site with misleading or inappropriate content. So, yeah, I guess this is back to the same whole fake news problem. Like, is the onus on us not us as journalists, but us as just all people of us, you know, yeah, reading online to check your sources. You know, don't just believe what you want to believe. But that is so ingrained in, you know, our psyche. There's, right, just the confirmation bias. Like, oh, you know, there's people like who wanted to believe that Hillary Clinton was a horrible person. And so any kind of fake news that might have led them to believe that more, they're going to accept it because that's what our psychology tells us. It wants to confirm what we already think is true.
Yeah, what we're searching for an answer for. And I mean, another wrinkle in this, of course, is, you know, a big part of why this is so complicated is that this isn't just Google search, right? Like, these featured snippets appear in search, and that's one thing. I kind of feel like I'm so used to like doing a search and coming up with results that aren't that I can recognize almost immediately. That's obviously not the right one. There's probably something else out there. When you're talking about a device like Google Home, all it does is talk to you, and you don't get to see any other context. You, mm-hmm, just get what it speaks to be the answer to that question that you asked it. And in the case of these, that's what you got. You got these answers with no extra context around it. And that's a really big challenge. I don't know if that means that, I mean, obviously something needs to be figured out about featured snippets and how they choose what a good result is versus a bad one. But I don't know if you get rid of that, because you get rid of that entirely. And Google Home as a product needs to be rebuilt from the ground up, because so much of that functionality is built around this.
Yeah, I mean, it gets back to, what are the questions we are asking? What's the weather? What year was George Washington born? You know, those kinds of things. But if you're asking, like, which presidents were, you know, part of the KKK, that's going to be, I mean, I know that the Amazon Echo would never even attempt to answer that question, you know, and not because Amazon has decided that they, you know, want to take the moral ground as far as like fake news is concerned. It's just that that's not the capabilities that are built into it. But I think Google's promise is you can really converse with, right, this device and really get the help that you need. So, you know, I don't know. It gets back to, like, what are we asking? And especially, you know, this is the moment where I say, think of the children. But we are, you know, we are putting these devices in our homes when our kids are saying, like, yeah, what did we win the Vietnam War? Like, oh, well, you know, ask Siri, ask, you know, the Echo, ask. And it's like, there's, you know, there's not always going to be one answer to that, and we need to be responsible for making sure, and schools need to be responsible for making sure that kids understand that that some, you know, a device can answer the question, that there's, right, bigger background there.
Absolutely. Fitbit is updating its smaller form factor Alta wearable to the new Alta HR. Takes the slim sleep and step tracker and adds a continuous heart rate monitor after they've spent a full year of development. I guess the big challenge here was shrinking a heart rate monitor down enough to fit inside the small wristband. The battery on the Alta HR is rated at around 7 days on a full charge, costs $150, and it'll be available in April. So Fitbit, arguably one of the best, the best-selling wearable maker globally, although they've been having some issues, having some challenges, as everybody in the wearable market is. But this is another entry. What do you think?
I think it's cute. I like that you can, it's slim. I could imagine, keeping it on at night, which I think is the big thing that they're aiming at.
Yeah.
You know, they're poking at Apple, which you have to charge at night unless you have this, elaborate charging plan, you know, and then keeping it on at night, to track your sleep. I mean, sleep tracking has always sounded like something I'd want to do, but then, what do you do with the data? Like, I get that this is going to be better data, that they're updating it, that you can, if you move around in your sleep, that might mean that you are having bad sleep, but it just might mean that you move around a lot in your sleep.
Right, yeah. And using the accelerometer is only one signal.
Right, yeah. So now they're sending more signals. So if sleep tracking is really important to you, I think we've sort of been sold a bill of goods on that. You know, it's like, yes, I know that if I get more sleep, I will be healthier, happier, wealthier, smarter, all those things. But is tracking my sleep going to mean that I sleep better? I don't know.
Yeah. Quantified self strikes again. I guess at this point, you all know how I feel about quantified self, so yes. I won't go on my normal tangent. Apparently, the previous version of the Alta is going to stick around. It's $20 less. This is $20 more than the previous version. But so if you do want the slimmed down version that doesn't have the heart rate monitor, you can still get that $20 less. It's 25% smaller than the Fitbit Charge. And yeah, it really seems like this is aimed at sleep tracking above and beyond. But yeah, again, like I just don't know why I need to know that.
I know. Like, I feel like, I guess it's this, it's, you know, you feel about fitness the same way. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you, so I guess maybe that's the thing. Like, I need to be inspired to work out in some way. And like, I get this,
right.
You're intrinsically inspired to work out. I need an extrinsic way to work out. So that's my Apple Watch. So I guess maybe there are people who need some sort of extrinsic encouragement. I don't need any encouragement to go to sleep. It's 10 o'clock. I'm asleep. And it's wonderful. And no one has to force me to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, really. I mean, I'm going to pass out the second I hit the pillow. Yes. I don't have any of those issues. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask about this and about fitness. But I mean, ultimately, it's worth it to somebody. You know what I mean? If that's going to improve somebody's state of mind because they have the ability to track that and then make changes as a result of that information, great. $150. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Right. Chris Vickery, a security researcher for MacKeeper, says spam empire River City Media has accidentally exposed 1.4 billion email records, including names, addresses, and even some IP addresses, after not protecting a remote backup with a password. Vickery discovered the trove of data in January and then worked with MacKeeper Security Research Center, CSO Online, and Spam House to expose the illegal spam operation. Vickery claims to have looked up several people he knows in the list and declares it to be accurate information that has been online for an undetermined amount of time. River City Media claims to be a legal operation, but it's unlikely that they will survive, legal or not, after this breach. What will survive, however, is all of our data that is now online.
Wah, 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 wah.
So, yeah, it was a sloppy user error. And it's hard to feel bad for the spammers that they, you know, revealed all this stuff. It's much easier to feel bad for us because they had our information. They, you know, it's much worse. You know, that spam email you were going to get seems pretty good compared to what all of our information might now, what someone might now do with that information, our email address combined with our actual address and our IP address. So, and it was an amazing look into what a spam operation can do.
Totally.
They said they send out a billion bulk emails a day. They had proof that they netted $36,000 in one day by targeting 18 million Gmail accounts and 15 million AOL accounts.
I mean, when you're talking about just the sheer number of accounts that are getting these blasts, a certain percentage, probably a very, an incredibly small percentage of those are going to actually respond and follow through on whatever the kind of action is within the email. But it happens. And the more you send out, the more you're going to get back. That's why these things are illegitimate. It's fascinating look inside how this stuff works. Maybe a lot of this is well-known information, and this is just my first time looking at it. But a couple of things that stood out to me. One was the use of warm-up accounts. And I've always kind of wondered about this, kind of figured this was happening. And this is probably how, you know, like big name email accounts like Gmail and whatever crack down on spam. But basically, their systems have to determine whether an email, you know, is trustable or not. And so what these companies will do is they have their own warm-up accounts on all these servers or services. And so they send their messages out in a low number to all of these warm-up accounts initially to allow those systems to realize that those users aren't reporting them as bad messages. And as a result, that you know, they give it a clearance, you know, give it a green light. Well, these are good messages. And then they can send it out and blast everybody until it gets caught at that point. But by that point, it's hit so many emails that, you know, it kind of got through.
So they're like the opening band.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The opening band that they control.
Right.
They're playing in the opening band. And then another thing was CoReg emails. It actually points out that most of the emails on this list came from something called CoReg. And what that is, because no one's going to knowingly, you know, or purposefully share their email address with these spam lists that get passed around, you know, between all of these different places. So the CoReg is when you go to a site and you give your email address for something like a free gift in exchange for your email address or exchange for a little bit of personal information. That free gift, as I always assumed, never actually really happens. It's just so complicated because of the sheer number, and they probably didn't have the intentions to do it at first. But that fine print allows for those partners to share with other partners, and those partners can share with other partners. So, I mean, basically everyone has our information anyways, regardless of whether we found this list or not. It's already passing around a million different places.
Yeah, so don't sign up for free gifts.
No, free gift.
You're getting the free gift now, your email address and possibly your regular address on the dark web or the light web.
Depressing. Well, in other news, Consumer Reports takes a lot of things into consideration when it reviews the products that it covers, and now they've committed to tracking cybersecurity and privacy concerns as part of its scoring process. The nonprofit group collaborated with a number of organizations to devise methods for accurately rating the hackability of products, and will implement those into their tests gradually over time. They say they're kind of starting it out slow because it's really complex. It's really complicated to know what to look for. I mean, it's actually pretty overwhelming. So they have to kind of peel it back at first, start slow. But ultimately, this is going to be a big part of how they rate products going forward.
This is fantastic news.
Yeah.
I think this is the happiest news that we've reported in weeks, I would say. I'm so excited. I'm a Consumer Reports nerd. I am a subscriber of the actual magazine. I love reading it. And this is exactly what we've sort of called for, because, you know, when the Mirai botnet, things like that, we were just like, what are you going to do? You know, these devices, we're filling our homes with these Internet of Things devices, and there's no standard. And so this is going to be a standard. Part of this is being funded by a grant from the Craig Newmark Foundation from Craigslist.
That's right.
Which is, it's always heartwarming for me to see, like, he could have been Mark Zuckerberg. He could have been, you know, Travis Kalanick. He could have created a huge company, and he just never wanted to. Like, he always wanted to do things like this, like things that we really needed. And I say thank you, Craig.
Yeah. I would completely agree. I forgot about that. Security practices, information collection, proper deletion of data from an account or deletion of data from devices. I mean, you know, more and more products, and especially products that Consumer Reports is looking at, you know, it's all internet connected. This is just like the wave of where we are right now with consumer technology, is that everything's becoming internet connected. And what we know a lot over the past year is that IoT and these smaller devices are really bad at security, or just aren't thinking about it. So if a company like Consumer Reports is thinking about it and applies pressure in that regard, hopefully that's yet another force that pushes them to make their products more secure, and then we all win. Yay, we all win.
Yes, you win. Enter your email address. Don't enter your email address.
No.
Bloomberg says shares of Snap have fallen for the first time since the company's IPO last week. The dip is blamed on the recommendations of analysts, none of whom recommend buying the stock. Now, well-known firm Needham & Company calls it a lottery stock and says the more glamorous the IPO, the more likely it is to fall, which is so shocking for a company that became known for dirty photos and puking rainbows. Snap opened at $17 a share, grew to 44%, and then went up another 10% on Friday to close just over $27. But then today it dropped at least 8% last time I checked. Needham puts the value at between $19 and $23 a share. Some analysts say to sell, some say to hold, but like I said, none of them say to buy. Do not buy. And, you know, they blame all the things we've talked about. Competitors are stealing their best features. You know, there's no way to hold on to all those daily active users and just a whole lot of other things that if you read down into, you know, the information that they put out to investors, it doesn't look like a company that you really want to buy now, at least.
Yeah, I am by no means whatsoever a stock an analyst, advisor in any way. It's why I've never done the stock market because I'm just afraid of making all the wrong moves. But I will trust the things that I read in this regard. And I mean, you know, there's a lot of things going against it. The shares being non-voting, for example, like why would shareholders not want to get in on this? Non-voting shares, Snap, you know, specified in the S-1 that they recognize they may never be profitable. I'm wondering if that's just something all companies say because there is that possibility, but Snap made a point to point that out. Also that they don't intend to pay dividends in the foreseeable future. So that's kind of a, you know, something that you, I suppose you would hope as a shareholder that you don't get. And then also this whole kind of idea of Snap entering the ad market and wanting to, you know, kind of go toe to toe with Facebook and with Google, which is just such a Herculean task to pull off, especially where they are right now. The ad market, you know, rockets, you know, to the sky over the next 5 years, maybe Snap can capture some of that, but kind of taking it over from Facebook and Google right now, the monsters that they are, that just seems like a huge hurdle. And I don't know how you trust a company like Snap to do that.
No, even no matter how much you love the puking rainbows, which I do. Mm-hmm. Link, who I have just learned is the hero of time. Link has an iPhone. After the break, we'll talk to Kyle Orland from Ars Technica about other secrets that the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild holds. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. I just bought a house, almost done with the process, and I can tell you that when it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it is really important to work with someone who you can trust, who has your best interest in mind. It's a complicated process, a lot of things to sign. You want to be able to trust who you're working with. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in just minutes. You can even adjust the rate and the length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Don't forget to add the TNT. Tell them we sent you there. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support.
Everybody's apparently Nintendo Switch crazy, or it might be that they're Zelda crazy. Joining us to get to the bottom of what makes Breath of the Wild so special is Kyle Orland from Ars Technica. How's it going, Kyle?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. So you spent a solid amount of time with Nintendo's launch title for the Switch. Actually, you spent time with it before everyone else, so you could kind of go,
yeah. Not to brag or anything.
I know, exactly. So first things first, does it live up to all the hype? I saw so many people talking about this game over the weekend.
So the hype for an average Zelda game is about here, maybe up here. It's up to your nose already, any Zelda game. The hype for this one already reached up here.
Yeah.
And I think it really deserves it. It changes so much about the Zelda formula that's really been bugging me for a long time. You go into a Zelda game, it's got this rhythm to it that over the decades has been, you know, kind of boring in a way. You go into a dungeon, you get the key item in that dungeon, you need that item to beat the boss, and then you use that item to find your way to the next dungeon, and you kind of go in this stair-step pattern through the game, and it pushes you right towards the ending. And Breath of the Wild just throws that all out the window. It really gives you very little information, and it lets you travel wherever you want. You can go to Ganon almost immediately after a very short tutorial area, and you will die very quickly, but the game will let you go there and try it out. You can get places where you really should not be and face enemies that will really hurt you. And that sense of mystery and exploration and the lack of hand-holding really makes Zelda feel like it did back in the NES days when it was, you know, a game where that no one knew anything about and a new adventure experience.
Wow. How's the pacing on this game, and how long did it take you to kind of get through the whole experience?
It's a slow-paced game. There are long sections where you'll just be wandering around all by yourself. Not much music in the background. There's no, like, driving adventure score. Maybe you'll have a horse to help you get across the vast plains in a quicker way. But really, there's very large open spaces, and it takes a while to get across them, even if you have the best tools available. That said, once you get to the action-packed parts, there can be quite a bit going on at a few times. But this is a game that could easily occupy you for 100 hours, maybe more, if you want to collect literally everything that's in there. I have not gotten that far, but there's definitely a lot that I haven't seen. I'm still exploring.
So can you get this game on any other platform besides the Switch?
Yeah, there's a Wii U version, which a lot of people seem to be forgetting about. The Wii U, already the redheaded stepchild of the Nintendo lineup. It only sold 12 million units, which is very low for a Nintendo system, especially after the Wii, which sold over 100 million. But a lot of people still have it, and from what I've heard, the Wii U version is a little less technically sound. There's a little bit of a frame rate issue, but for the most part, it's the same exact game. You do not have to buy a $300 system to play Breath of the Wild. You only need to do that if you want to take the Switch along with you and play it on the go, which I'll admit is a very nice way to play the game. You can take it to bed, take it to the bathroom, obviously. You can play it while someone else is taking up the TV. So I think this is a game that you shouldn't wait on just because you don't have a Switch. If you have a Wii U, or if you're considering getting a Wii U for things like Mario Maker or the other great games on that system, Breath of the Wild is one you should definitely not sleep on.
I mean, would you say that Breath of the Wild is what Nintendo needed as a launch title to kind of showcase what the Switch is capable of? Does this have you positive on have you feeling positive about what's to come?
They really do. When a system launches, you need something to set it apart from all the other consoles out there, especially if you have an Xbox One or a PS4. Why am I getting a Switch? It's not for any of the other 8 games in the launch lineup. There's, you know, 1-2 Switch is kind of a fun party game for if you get a bunch of friends drunk. And, you know, a game like Snipperclips is a cute cooperative puzzle, but it's not going to keep you busy for more than an hour or two, probably. Mm-hmm. But a game like Zelda Breath of the Wild really shows off Nintendo's design chops and the power of the system. It proves what you can do with a Switch, and it's an experience that you can't get on another system. It's the definition of a system seller. Whether it's enough to sell the system with literally not much else and very little coming on the horizon, in fact, as far as big budget games go, that's an open question. Do you really want to spend $300 just for this game, or does it make sense to wait to see what's coming, see what the Mario game, Mario Odyssey, is like near the end of the year, or even buy the Wii U version of Breath of the Wild and wait a little bit to see if the Switch comes down in price or if the software market comes out?
I enjoyed my time with Snipperclips. It wasn't long, but I never realized I wanted to cut people up like a pair of scissors.
It's a very cute game, but it's not the kind of game that I think people are going to buy a $300 system for on its own, unfortunately.
No,
not like
so. No, exactly. Okay, so Gizmodo said that Link has an iPhone. And not only that, but there are already people making cases for this phone. I saw the picture. It looked like it could be any phone. What do you think?
It's like the tablet. I feel like it's like his version of the Nintendo Switch. Link has his own Switch. It's kind of like they did in Skyward Sword, where, you know, you would swing your sword with the Wii Motion Plus accessory, and then he would swing his sword. It's they've kind of done this kind of thing in the past. It's a cute reference to the real world and Link's world, but it really doesn't play that much into the game. Sometimes people will see it on Link's hip and they'll be like, oh, that's the amazing Sheikah slate. You must be the hero of legend. And he'll kind of put it in a portal to get information. But really, it's just a cute nod to the system design, I think.
It doesn't look anything like an iPhone. It's a handheld device. That's about the only similarity. And it actually looks like a portable gaming device more than an iPhone.
Yeah, it's weird in the land of Hyrule where there's so little technology. Or it's like Indiana Jones style technology, you know, where everything's made of stone and somehow magically moves with elevators and, you know, yeah, big stone doors opening up. You don't really think about it too hard.
You see, us iPhone users, we see a device that looks like this, and that's, you know, what else could it be?
You see what you want to see.
Why would Link have anything else, really?
Nintendo's just copying Apple again.
Yeah, exactly. No kidding. Just add that to the list. How much of a role do you think because it has a very unique art style, how much of a role did that play in your enjoyment of the game?
I really like the art style. It reminds me a little bit of Legend of Zelda Wind Waker, which came out on the GameCube over a decade ago now. And it's a little bit more refined, though. You'll come to these cliffs. You come up to the cliff, and you'll see this vast vista across. And that's a thing you get in a lot of other games, but it hasn't really been so much in Zelda games, I feel. They've been more compact. There's a very nice picture right there. You get the lighting coming in, and things look a little more realistic than they did in Wind Waker, but not so much to the point where it reaches that uncanny valley level where you're picking out the details that are wrong. It's still a little bit cartoony, as you can see in the fox there, moving with very exaggerated movements and very bright, bold colors. Really, there are just so many striking images in this game you'll come to, and you just want to look at the landscape and take a picture. And Switch, thankfully, has a button you can hit to share those pictures with Twitter and Facebook very easily. I think that's going to get a lot of use.
Yeah, and, you know, I've not owned a modern Nintendo console in a very long time. But one thing that I have heard time and time again, at least in the latest iterations of Nintendo systems, is that power-wise, they don't compare to the next generation, the current generations of competitors like, you know, PlayStation or the Xbox. Do you think the Nintendo Switch, it's still underpowered by today's standards comparably, right? And does it really matter at all?
Yes, it's definitely true that you're not going to be able to get as much power on the Nintendo Switch. If a game like Uncharted 4, with the amount of detail and the amount of stuff going on in that game, I really doubt that could run on the Switch. That said, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild proves that you don't need that much raw power to still have a very visually striking game. You can use art direction and playing to the strengths of the console to really create some striking visuals without the need for, the latest and greatest hardware. We saw this in the last generation or two generations ago now with a game like Super Mario Galaxy and its sequel on the Wii. You know, this was a system that didn't even have HD graphics, but I dare you to go back to that game and look at how it looks. And it still looks great, I would say, even without the high definition. And it's just got bright, bold colors, and everything is really easily readable. I feel like Zelda Breath of the Wild continues that tradition. Nintendo does it better than everyone else. Everyone else using the Switch will be hard to see if they can get as much out of it as the people in Nintendo can.
Right, absolutely. Finally, last question, quick one. Where does it rank in your mind comparatively to other Zelda games?
This is a tough one. I've been grappling with this. It's definitely my favorite 3D Zelda, even beating Ocarina of Time, which will get a lot of people mad, I think. I think Link to the Past might be better, but that might be because the first time I played that game, I was 12 years old. And the Zelda that you play at 12 years old is always going to be the best one in your mind to some level. But yeah, I flip a coin.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like a great game, and I can't wait to get my hands on it and try it out for myself. Kyle Orland from ArsTechnica.com. Where can people follow you online?
At Kyle ORL, or go to ArsTechnica.com and read all our stuff.
Right on. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Kyle. We really appreciate it.
Take care.
No problem.
All right. Talk to you soon.
So we received two emails about our discussion of iOS and Chrome in the classroom last week. First, Jason writes, you mentioned that iOS does a good job of locking out users or enterprising children from installing random applications, but commented about Windows not necessarily being able to do so. Now, Microsoft is actually working on a feature that blocks the installation of regular applications and can only be installed through the store, so it sounds like it might be coming. I personally use Windows at home for my kids, but lock it down slightly with the use of Active Directory and group policy, not the norm for most families. Schools could do this if they wanted to, and then add BitLocker into the mix to stop anyone from getting around changing the OS settings externally.
Until the kids figure out their way around it.
Yeah.
Because it always happens.
Right. And I think that I think I'll read my ex email because this goes along with part of the problem with that. Keith, who we've heard from before on this topic, he is an educational technology specialist with the Alabama Department of Education. He says, as both a Google for Education certified training and a certified Apple teacher, I see advantages and disadvantages to both platforms, but I suspect that Chromebook growth is related to cost, but not solely device cost. Effective management of iPads can be challenging and almost requires a third-party mobile device management system. And even with that, it still requires quite a bit of attention. The Google management is a bit easier, but even more important is the management of users. Oftentimes in education, budgets dictate a single position be in charge of both the educational aspects and the network management aspects of ed tech. A district may have a strong network admin that isn't as adept at the integration of technology in the classroom, or someone with an educational background that doesn't have as strong as a technical background. In this case, Google's G Suite Apps for Education is much easier for the non-network admin to manage effectively. So I suspect that might be the same problem with Windows. If you're talking about BitLocker, and you know, if you're just an educator and you don't have a background in system administration, it can be really complicated, I think, to use some of those other systems. And it sounds like Google really tried to make that as easy as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming up, we've all encountered trolls on the internet, but have we been a troll and we just didn't realize it? First, let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. You're looking for the thing, but it's not under the couch. It's not in the cupboard or on the table. Your meeting's in 20 minutes. The thing is your keys and you can't find it. Well, we've all been there, but now with Tracker, you never have to worry about losing things again. The Tracker Bravo is a coin-sized device constructed with anodized aluminum for the best, thinnest, most durable tracking. You can locate misplaced keys, wallets, bags, computers, pretty much anything in seconds. You just pair Tracker to your smartphone, you can attach it to any item, and you'll find its precise location with the tap of a button. And that's all there is to it. Lose your phone? Well, you can press the button on your Tracker device or ask your Amazon Alexa, and your phone rings even when it's on silent. The phone can track up to 10 devices at once, and you can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you happen to leave your item behind. With over 4.5 million devices shipped, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map, even if it's miles away. The Tracker app actually records its last known location on a map, and then when another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your item, you'll then receive a GPS update of where your item is located. So hopefully you can go and scoop it up. And with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no reason not to give it a try. Stop losing your stuff today. Go to thetracker.com and enter promo code TNT. You'll get a free Tracker Bravo with any order. That's thetracker.com. Promo code TNT for your free Tracker Bravo with any order. We thank Tracker for their support of Tech News Today. TNT's fan of the day is Greg Rahe on Twitter. I probably got it wrong both times. Who sent us this pic in front of his Tower of Power. And of course, TNT is included in any Tower of Power because we're TNT. Boom, like the dynamite.
Did you make up Tower of Power? Or did he send that some...
I made it up.
Oh.
Because it's awesome. Kind of a tower of power.
Yeah, it really is.
It's powerful. Yeah. It's tower-ish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Explosion was necessary. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we'll find it.
I was just trolling you because I'm cranky and it's nighttime.
And it's Monday. It's Monday.
Right, exactly. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, Christopher Mims says that we are all internet trolls sometimes. According to research from Stanford and Cornell, ordinary people are just as likely as sociopaths to troll online based on your mood and the surrounding context of the situation. They also found that people are more likely to troll at night versus in the day. The study defines trolling behavior as anything that falls outside acceptable bounds defined by a community. The researchers used observational analysis augmented with 16 million comments on CNN.com to prove that anyone can be a troll. Even you can be a troll. This was probably not surprising. The experiment consisted of two main parts, a quiz followed by a discussion, and trolling ranged from outright swearing to personal attacks, veiled insults, sarcasm, and off-topic statements. And they used Amazon Mechanical Turk to do part of this study. We've talked about them before. They're the people that you can pay almost nothing to do anything. They got paid $8 an hour, so I'd be trollish too.
Is this more of an analysis of CNN's trollish activity? I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of trolls everywhere on the internet, but I guarantee you, if you go to CNN and you look at the comments, you're going to find a whole lot of really divisive comments on both sides of the political spectrum, and not a whole lot of really good stuff said in there.
Right, but maybe that was why they used CNN as a good example of a place where people control. I don't know. You know, you can say a study says anything, right?
Yeah.
But so, I mean, it's more interesting to look at this and really, I mean, think about, like, we've all been there.
Yeah,
we've all done it.
I was trying to think back in my past, have I ever dropped anything that, like, because it's really about, like, being offensive to the person on the other end and not, or maybe recognizing when you say it that it would be offensive. I'd like to think that no, but I'm sure somewhere, I mean, I've been on the internet a long time. I'm sure somewhere I dropped something because I was cranky and the person on the other end, you know, didn't like what I had to say.
Yeah, I've never seen it, but I'll do some Google searching tonight. I'll pay someone on Mechanical Turk.
To find my trollish behavior.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what I find myself sometimes, you know, criticizing someone like super famous and then just not really thinking about like, hey, they might see that and how would that sound? And
yeah.
I usually don't. I mean, I usually think about it and then, you know, I mean, I don't know. I have a million Twitter drafts that I didn't send. Sometimes all you need to do is write the draft and then not actually.
And how many times do I do that? I feel like nowadays I write more drafts than I actually write tweets.
Yeah.
But no, that's true, right? Like, and I don't know. I know that I've experienced that on Twitter where like I put out a comment about something that's totally in the current kind of sphere about somebody in particular that I feel is so far out of reach that I can safely go online and be critical or judgy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And after the fact, but then when you kind of turn that on, you know, upside down or look at it backwards and say, well, what if this tweet was presented to that person? How would that make that person feel?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thinking about it that way, I probably have done this before.
Yeah.
But there is a difference. I believe this. There is a difference between people who sometimes are cranky and leave things that might be offensive to someone and someone who is just a downright troll all the time. And this is just how they operate on the internet.
Right.
There's a big difference between those two things.
Yeah. I think I find it's troll is sort of too nice. Like I call those people sociopaths.
Okay. We've all been trolls. Not all of us have been sociopaths.
Yes, it's true. Yeah. I think that it's, I don't know. It's a tough one. What I like about this too is how they defined trollish behavior by the you know, the standards that were set in the community.
Right.
So it's like you could go to a Reddit, you know, you could go to some, you know, a Reddit board. What do you call them? Boards?
Reddit. Yeah, subreddit.
Yeah, subreddit. And you could, I don't spend that too much time there, but you could, because you could go there and say like super mean things and it's not really trollish because it's the way the community operates and those are accepted boundaries for the community. And I love that there are places like that, you know, and I want to continue to have places like that. You know, Twitter, it might be a little bit rougher than Facebook, you know, Instagram might be a little bit calmer, you know, who knows? And it's just like, if we can if we can just not try to put that standard on every place, that same standard on every place, that's the problem, I think, now, because it's like when Twitter, like you might have a community, Twitter, there's no communities on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So there's no rules that are set by the community. So you have one person that has 20 followers and they say something that they believe is within the bounds of their community. And then it becomes retweeted and sent everywhere. And then suddenly that person, you know, is publicly shamed or,
right,
or whatnot.
It's broken out of that context and spun out a million different ways.
Yeah, which I think is one of the many problems with Twitter, that it, why Reddit is a different place, because there are actual communities, subreddits, as you say they are called.
Twitter, we're different from Reddit.
Yeah.
We're different than Reddit.
Totally. If they could convince everyone of that, I think they could make money.
Someday, one could hope. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
And subscribe if you want to be part of our community. If you want to see us in person, please do. We love to have a live audience. Just email tickets at twit.tv. And I think I forgot to tell you where you subscribe, but you probably know by now, TNT, twit.tv/TNT. And I am at Megan Maroney. Say whatever you want to me on Twitter. If I deem you a sociopath, I will just block you. And that's how you know you're a sociopath.
And now you know. And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to Brian, our technical director for the day and most of the week. Thanks to Burke for helping out in the studio. I'm sorry we didn't get to your notes today.
Put them all out there.
Yes. We want a rotation of all the things you had to say that we didn't read. I always trust the result labeled ad. Mm-hmm, that's good practice. Mm-hmm. The AI or whatever needs to be able to flag conspiracy sites. Okay. Good tip. And then, if it was an iPhone, he would be holding it vertically. Too much logic, Burke. Too much logic.
Mm-hmm. And if it were an iPhone.
You heard it for Megan.
I told you I was cranky. Is that not part of our boundaries of our
Quit
community?
Quit being a troll, Megan.
Okay, sorry.
Thanks to Kevin for editing the show, and thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.